Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Should I Grovel at His Feet by Daniel Rogers. I need some guys who know how to kick butt and take names, but all I have are priests who sweep and meditate. I'm at my wit's end. I've got to do something to free Allura from that madman, I said as Bob meditated. Don't interrupt. I know Bob's a shaman and he loves to meditate, but I'm too worked up to stop now. Who knows what Targan is doing to Allura? Not that I'm too worried. She's tougher than most. Well, than everyone. But it's the principle that matters. What part of don't interrupt do you not understand? Bob said without opening an eye. How can you meditate at a time like this? Bob stood, snuffed out his candle, took a deep breath, and slowly exhaled. Clearly I can't. You're worried. I understand, but I need a clear mind to see the answer. Fortunately, I've been meditating long before you barged in, and the gods gave me the solution. Bob led me to an obscure corner of the temple grounds. Weeds and grass grew in the cracks of the cobblestone path we took. Clearly, few people used it. We exited the wooded area onto grassy hills with several huts dotted around, and curiously spaced between the huts stood straw dummies on wooden poles, being attacked by dozens of priests dressed in black and gray robes. They hit, poked, and karate chopped the dummies like they were an old Jackie Chan movie. What are they doing? I asked. Training, Bob said. Training for what? You will see. Two priests spotted us and escorted us to the head honcho. At least he looked like the head honcho. Silver robe, muscular, cool hair, shoulder length with strands of gold braided in. I don't know how anyone else felt, but he impressed me. Shaman, we are honored. What brings you to our little corner? Not only did the dude look impressive, but his voice boomed out like the nameless voice actors who narrate movie trailers. I could listen to him all day. It's good to see you, Drac. It's been a long time. Bob nodded towards a hut. Could we speak privately? Once inside, we sat on the floor. The tiny place had no furniture, only banners with wise sayings on the walls. Drac, this is Drew Williams. You may know him as the winner of the Pick a Sacrifice tournament, but he's much more. As you can see, he came back, something no other sacrifice has done. Drac played it cool, but I thought I saw his eyes widen a bit. He's a god. He can pronounce my name, Bob said. Now I know I saw Drac's eyes widen. These guys are so impressed when I say Bob. I have no idea why they can't say it in their language, but they can't. May I ask a question? Drac asked me. I nodded. So on the god spectrum, are you high enough that I should grovel at your feet, or one of the lower gods that I should just be very respectful towards? I looked at Bob, completely lost. There's no need for groveling, Bob said. You asked why I'm here, a unique job, one you don't have to take if you feel uncomfortable. It's very sensitive. I'm listening, Drac said. It involves Targan and his elite guard. I swear I saw something in Drac's eyes when Bob mentioned Targan. They've imprisoned a god named Allura. Should I grovel at her feet? No, Drac. But I'd be very respectful. Unlike Drew, she can be scary at times. Anyway, I'd like for your team to rescue her. We've never opposed the secular government before. They stay on our side, and we stay on ours. It's always been that way. I know, and I understand if you choose not to, although I feel I should mention that a good, different god gave me a vision of you and your team. So choosing not to might offend that one. Is he the kind god who demands groveling? Maybe, I'm not sure yet, but you might want to be prepared to grovel if you ever meet him, Drac asked for some time to think it over, so he went back to the temple hall to kill some time. "Why do you think Drac can help us?" I asked. "Drac is the prime of my elite fighting priests called the Nakwaks. They study an ancient technique of fighting where every successful move puts their opponent to sleep." "You mean knocks them out?" "Less violent than that. They have only to touch the right spot, and it's nighty-night time." "Like Mr. Spock?" "Who?" "Never mind. Are they tough enough to take on the elite guard? I bet you my last credit they won't try to put anyone to sleep." "The Nakwaks are feared throughout the land. I'd say they are tough enough." A messenger entered with a note from Drac telling us he must decline. I went to my room depressed. I thought Drac would help. Now the only hope Alora has is me, and I only give myself a slight chance of saving her. She'd give me a zero chance. While sulking half the night and racking my brain to come up with a plan, I heard a knock at my door. Grinfo, my old friend, came in. "Rumor says Drac won't help you rescue Alora. Is it true?" Grinfo asked. I nodded. "That coward, he's been afraid of Targon since we were in school together." "You know Drac?" Grinfo laughed. "He's my big brother, or should I call him my big baby brother?" "Drac? A baby?" "Oh, I know, he looks impressive, but believe me, he's afraid. Targon used to bully him relentlessly when we were kids. But let me talk to him. I think I can get him to change his mind." "How?" "Don't tell anyone. I mean it. I pinky swear. Now what is it?" "My brother keeps showing off in front of this girl. I'm pretty sure that if I threaten to mention that he won't help the shaman rescue a god in front of her, Drac would be extremely embarrassed. And believe me, Drac fears being embarrassed more than he fears Targon, especially in front of this girl." The next day, Bob knocked on my door and told me that Drac had changed his mind. He will help after all. I told Bob I'm completely surprised and never saw that coming. Strangely, this girl that Drac likes has as much strength as Alora. I mean, she's not an android like Alora and able to throw cars around, but she still has strength. I smiled. Things are looking up. Show and Tell by Shannon Morse. And next up for Show and Tell is Angie. I walked up to the front of the classroom and squeezed my hand real tight. Miss Cook smiled at me and gave me a thumbs up. Miss Cook isn't really a cook, though. She's really my kindergarten teacher. Her name is real confusing. I think she should change it to Miss Teacher, but she said that's not how that works. Anyway, I took my biggest breath and started my story. The night I got inducted by aliens, I had my dog Bandit with me. He was peeing on a little baby stick tree that my mom wants to grow real bad. When we got it, it was an even littler stick that kind of looked like a fishing pole with a big glob of dirt all around the bottom. My dad dug a huge hole and stuck it right in the ground. And now my mom goes out to sing to it or something because she says it makes grow faster. I don't think the trees like her singing very much because it's still all skinny like an old man. Anyways, Bandit loves to lift his leg up all over it at night when mom can't yell at him to get off the damn tree. Miss Cook was not really smiling as much then, I think because I said the word damn. Oops. But I never say that, cause damn is a bad word that I'm not allowed to say, cause then I have to go in time out chair. But I also don't say it, cause I think it's funny when Bandit pees where he's not supposed to. Anyway, Bandit was by the tiny tree with his leg way up to the air, and he was whizzing all over that thing. My brother taught me that word, whiz. He said it's not like a wizard, it's like going pee real loud. And then all of a sudden, a bright light came flashing down us from the sky. I started feeling real weird in my tummy, like when I'm about to throw up on the carpet again. And then my feet came up off the ground and I started flying. Bandit had his ears stuck out like an airplane, and then he kind of looked like Dumbo, except he has triangular ears like Doritos and not big flappy elephant ears. I saw an alien movie once where they got sucked up into the alien ship, so I figured they'd look like big green bugs when we got up there, but really they don't. They had purpley kind of eyes and even purplier skin that had wrinkles all over, like when I swim in the pool too long. They talked like Zeep Zorp or something. I don't really know. It sounded all weird, like it was someone talking behind me, but then when I turned around, nobody was even there. The only word that I stood them say was beef. I think so. I took out some dog treats from my pocket. I was supposed to give them to Bandit if he was somewhere that was not on the stick tree, but I figured it was okay to share since Bandit didn't ever really pee in the right spot anyways. I tried to give one of them to the guy in the middle, but they were all too far away, and there was a big counter thing in the middle of the room in the way, so I just threw the treat to him. But he's really not that good at catching, and he kind of didn't even move at all, so it just stuck to his skin, its slime, and got all goopy. And here it is. I stuck out my slimy beef treat so everybody could see it. I waited for them to go like, ooh, and ah, but all they said, ooh, that's not even the right sound. My eyebrows got all scrunchy, and I kind of really felt like stomping my foot. Not you. It's cool. It's got alien slime on it. They should want to put this in that science place we went for the field trip. The museum, Miss Cook said, but she had a look like she didn't really like my show and tell that much. Then stupid Billy said he thinks I just sneezed on it and the slime is really my snot all over it. That got me real mad. No, it was from the alien, I yelled, but only a little. And besides, I'm not even done with my telling part. I stood up taller in my spot in front of everybody and kept going. Anyways, so the treat was stuck in the middle guy, and then I felt that oh-no feeling in my tummy because I remembered how much Bandit loves these beefy things, and he got a look on his face like he was going to do something real bad and make Mom say, damn. And he sure did. He drooled a big puddle on the ground, and then his tail started doing my favorite thing when he spins it all around wonky like a weird helicopter, except now it was not my favorite thing very much because I knew we were both about to probably have to sit in the alien's timeout chair. Bandit jumped all the way over that counter in front of them and landed right on top of the middle guy and was licking all over him trying to get the beef treat, but it was really stuck up kind of in that guy's neck area and it just wasn't coming off. Then there was slime all over the ground, too, and the alien was all jiggly like a blob, and Bandit thought it was so much fun to jump on him and lick that treat on his neck. But I thought maybe they must like cats better because those wrinkly purpley jelly guys did not look too happy. But also none of them were even helping the middle guy even at all. They just sat there looking all wrinkled and blobby with their alien mouths open super wide like they were singing opera. They looked like how Miss Cook looked when I just said damn earlier, even though it was just on purpose and I didn't even mean to. Anyway, so then I had to run over, and since I have fingers to use and not just a tongue, it was way easy for me to get the treat off. But now it's all sticky and slimy still, 'cause I didn't take it in the bath with me last night. That middle guy had Bandit's hair all stuck on him, and he looked like my slime whenever I drop it on the carpet. Then the spaceship started shaking, and the purpley guys got all orangish instead. I thought maybe that meant they were mad, and I was probably right, because then they sucked us back down to my backyard, just like how we came up, but backwards. As soon as we were back on the ground, the spaceship just zoomed away like it wanted to get the heck away from us. Me and Bandit just stood there for a little while, just looking at each other. Then Bandit turned around and threw it up all over the stick tree. The end. I waited for everyone to clap for me now that they knew the whole story of the slimy beef treat, but they started laughing instead, and not 'cause it's funny, but because they were being mean. Miss Cook stood up at the front of the class and made everyone be quiet. "Angie, you have a wonderful imagination," she said. I tried to tell her that it wasn't even my magic nation and that it happened for real, but she just told me stuff like, "That's enough, and have a seat." At 4 o'clock, it was time to go home. My dad picked me up in his big white car and asked me how did my day go at school. And I told him, "Fine," because I didn't even really feel like telling any more stories today. We drove home real quiet, and I just looked out the window, thinking about how nobody even believed me about the aliens. I could still feel the sticky wet of the beef treat in my pocket, and my throat felt like I swallowed a big chunk of gum, and my eyes started getting all runny. We were almost home, and then I saw Miss Cook get out of her car at a house close to mine. I blinked real hard to get the tears out of the way, because just right then when I was looking, something real bright flashed down on Miss Cook, and she started looking like she was flying in the air. Her legs were all swinging around crazy, and I just smiled, 'cause I knew she didn't even have any beef treats with her. A World Full Circle by Logan Richard. Ashla Reeves had been homeless for 2 years when the purple flash changed everything. 23 years old, but looking a decade older. She walked Westheimer Road with her head down, invisible to the lunch hour crowd. The factory had closed, the eviction had followed, and now she lived behind dumpsters and in doorways, her entire life compressed into a backpack. She was passing between a bank and a law office when reality tore open. The flash was purple, violent, impossibly bright, a vertical slash of crackling energy in the narrow alley. Before Ashla could process what she was seeing, a hand shot out and grabbed her wrist with impossible strength. The man who emerged wore clothes that shimmered and shifted, colors her mind couldn't categorize. His face was angular, sharp. It had an odd and faded mark under one of the eyes that held a desperate sadness. "Sorry, Ashla," he said, his voice tight with genuine regret, "but this needs to happen." Before she could ask how he knew her name, he pressed something into her hand. It was a knife, unlike any she'd ever seen. The blade seemed made of crystal or glass, pulsing with inner light that shifted through nameless colors. The handle was warm, almost alive against her palm. Then his hands were on her shoulders, spinning her with such force, her feet left the ground. The world became a blur, and she was flying backward into the crowd, arms outstretched, the strange knife clutched in her right hand. She collided with something soft. The knife met resistance for only a fraction of a second before sliding forward with terrible, smooth ease. The impact trampled up her arm, the moment when the blade found something vital and stopped. Time slowed. Ashla turned back toward the alley and saw the afterglow of another purple flash. The man was gone, leaving only ozone and the smell of thunderstorms. She looked down. An old man stood before her, beginning to fall. 70s, maybe 80s, with white hair and liver-spotted hands reaching toward the knife buried in his chest. His pale blue eyes met hers, filled with confusion, pain, and something that looked almost like relief. Blood seeped around the blade, straining his white shirt chrism. Ashla's hand was still on the handle, fingers locked in a grip she couldn't release. The old man's mouth opened, closed. No words came, just a soft exhalation. His life left his eyes quickly, quietly, as if it had been waiting for release. He crumpled to the ground, and Ashla's hand slipped off the ornate knife, leaving it embedded in his chest. Complete silence. The entire city seemed to hold its breath. Then someone screamed. The world became chaos, people shouting, backing away, pulling out phones. Ashla looked at her hands, so much blood. It had run down her arm, soaked her sleeve, dripped onto her jeans. The old man lay at her feet, eyes still open, staring at nothing. "No," Ashla whispered. "No, no, no, no." Her legs gave out. She sat on the sidewalk, trying to process the impossible sequence. The purple flash, the strange man, the knife, the old man's eyes. "She killed him," someone shouted. "She just stabbed him." The crowd formed a wall around her. Ashla couldn't move. She sat there, staring at her blood-covered hands, tears streaming down her face, saying no, 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 like a prayer. The police arrived within minutes. Ashley barely registered them, pulling her to her feet, handcuffing her. She didn't resist. At the station, a detective with tired eyes asked what happened. Ashley told him the truth. The purple flash, the strange man, the knife. He wrote it all down without expression, then left her alone for hours. Her court-appointed attorney was young, fresh out of law school. When she told him everything, his expression grew troubled. "Miss Reeves, no one is going to believe that story. A man appearing out of a purple flash? It sounds like something you made up." "But it's the truth," Ashla whispered. "I believe that you believe it," he said carefully. "But dozens of witnesses saw you stab that man. None saw anyone else. Security cameras show you walking down the sidewalk, then suddenly stabbing the victim. No purple flash, no mysterious man, just you. You're going to be charged with first-degree murder, and you're most likely going to prison." Something inside Ashla cracked like ice under too much weight. The courtroom was packed. Ashla sat in an orange jumpsuit, hands shackled, unable to look at the judge or the family of Harold Brennan, retired teacher, grandfather of five, sitting in the front row. Faces twisted with grief and rage. The arraignment was brief. Murder in the first degree. Not guilty plea. Bail denied. The crane unit rose out of the flat Texas landscape like a monument to human failure. Concrete, razor wire, guard towers. Ashla was processed. Fingerprints, photographs, medical exam, psychological evaluation. Number 847392, Block C, Cell 47. She was given a cellmate. Bogan was waiting when the guard pushed Ashla inside, 6 feet, 4 inches of muscle and scar tissue, arms like tree trunks, face carved from granite. She stood in the center of the small cell, arms crossed, looking down at Ashla with an unreadable expression. "You're the new fish," Bogan said, her voice surprisingly soft, which somehow made her more intimidating. "I'm Bogan. This is my cell. You're just living in it. There are rules. Don't touch my stuff. Don't talk to guards about anything that happens in here. Pull your weight. Understand?" Ashla heard other prisoners whispering Bogan's name as they passed the cell. There was fear in those whispers and respect and something else. Awe, maybe. Ashla nodded slightly, then walked past Bogan to the vacant bunk against the wall. She crawled onto it, turned to face the concrete, and lay there, staring at nothing, unblinking. Bogan stood confused. She'd had cellmates before, dozens of them over her 15 years in Crane Unit, and they all reacted the same way. Fear, mostly. Some tried to act tough. Some cried, some tried to befriend her. But this girl, this tiny slip of a thing, just lay there like she'd already died and her body hadn't gotten the message yet. Bogan shook her head and climbed to her bunk, wondering what this girl's story was. The next months passed in gray fluorescence. Ashla moved through prison like a ghost, speaking only when spoken to, eating mechanically, sleeping when lights went out. She attended mandatory programs, but was never really there. The other prisoners began to notice this quiet mouse rooming with the most dangerous woman in Crane Unit. They asked questions during yard time, meals, the long empty hours. What was her story? What was she in for? Ashla barely spoke, but the prisoners were persistent. Finally, in the cafeteria, a woman named Dries asked point blank, "What did you do to end up here?" Ashla looked up from her tray. "I killed an old man," she said quietly, "by accident." The cafeteria erupted in laughter. This weak little thing couldn't kill anyone, but the laughter just meant more questions. Over the following weeks, Ashla started talking. Small things at first, what she was used to, what her mother had been like, what she missed. Then one day during yard time, someone asked what she would do if she got out. Ashla stared up at the small square of sky. "If I had even a chance, a half a chance, I'd go back to school, finish my degree in social work. I'd get a little apartment, nothing fancy, just somewhere clean and safe. I'd get a cat, and I'd work with homeless kids because I know what it's like." The laughter died. There was something in Ashla's voice that made this impossible future seem almost real. Bogan, standing nearby, felt something shift in her chest. She'd spent 15 years accepting this was her life now. But listening to Ashla talk about half chances, she felt something she hadn't felt in years. Hope. She started following Ashla around, protecting her when other inmates prodded too much. As months turned into years, the other prisoners began to see what Bogan saw. Ashla never got angry, never fought, never played the games everyone else played. She just existed, this quiet presence that made everyone think about their own lives, their own half chances. The change was subtle at first. Fewer fights. More prisoners attending voluntary programs. The library suddenly had a waiting list. Women were studying for their GEDs. Dr. Martinez, the prison psychologist, noticed violence had dropped 40% over 2 years. Participation in rehabilitation programs had tripled. She interviewed prisoners, and over they mentioned Ashla's name. But when Martinez requested a session with Ashla, the young woman had nothing to say. She just stared at the wall, answering with single words or silence. 10 years passed. Ashla was 33, though she looked older. The parole board had been lenient, citing her perfect behavior and positive influence. She had 2 years left. Bogan had been released 3 years earlier after completing her college degree and showing exceptional rehabilitation. She'd hugged Ashla goodbye, promised to write. The letters had stopped about a year ago. Ashla assumed Bogan had moved on. That was good. That was what was supposed to happen. So when the guard came to her cell one morning and told her she had a visitor, Ashla was confused. She didn't have visitors. She never had visitors. She was led to the visiting room and sat down on one of the booths. She picked up the phone on her side of glass partition, barely registering who it was that had come to visit her. The person on the other side was massive, making the phone look like a toy in her hand. They wore an expensive-looking suit jacket that was tailored to fit their large frame, and their hair was styled professionally. It took Ashla a moment to recognize them. "Hello, Rumi," the visitor said, and Ashla's eyes widened slightly, the first real emotion she'd shown in years. It was Bogan, but not the Bogan she remembered. This Bogan was different, still large, still muscular, but there was a softness to her face that hadn't been there before, a lightness. She was smiling, really smiling, and her eyes were bright with something that looked like joy. "Bogan?" Ashla whispered. "Dr. Bogan now, actually," Bogan said, her smile widening. "I finished my PhD last year, quantum physics. I'm working for a company that's doing groundbreaking research in anti-gravity technologies. We're on the verge of something big, Ashla, something that could change everything. Ashla stared at her former cellmate, trying to process this information. How? You, Bogan said simply. You changed my life. You made me think about what I could be if I had half a chance. So I took that half chance and I ran with it. I went back to school. I worked harder than I've ever worked at anything, and I made it. She paused, then continued. I also got married. Her name is Sarah. She's a teacher. And I have a son. Bogan gestured behind her, and a small figure appeared, a little boy, maybe 3 years old, with dark curly hair and bright, curious eyes. He pressed his face against the glass, looking at Ashla with an intensity that seemed unusual for such a young child. This is Addison, Bogan said, her voice soft with love. Addison, say hi to Miss Ashla. The boy didn't wave immediately. Instead, he stared at Ashla with an expression that was far too knowing, far too focused for a three-year-old. His eyes locked onto hers with a recognition that made her skin prickle. Then slowly, deliberately, he raised his small hand and waved. Hi, he said, his voice clear and measured in a way that felt oddly adult. Ashla stared at the child, her heart suddenly pounding. There was something familiar about him. Maybe it was the shape of his face, the way his eyes seemed to look through her rather than at her, and the small birthmark on his left cheek just below his eye. She leaned closer to the glass, studying his features, the birthmark. She'd seen it before. The stranger in the strange clothing all those years ago had a birthmark in the exact same place, the exact same shape. How old did you say he was? Her voice came out strangled. Bogan's expression softened. Three. He'll be four in November. I had him with my husband before we divorced. Sarah and I got married 2 years ago, and she's been an amazing mother to him. The mathematics clicked into place with terrible precision. 3 years old, born roughly 11 years ago, 1 year after she'd murdered Harold Brennan. Harold Brennan's grandson. Ashla gripped the edge of the booth, her knuckles white. The man in the shimmering clothes, desperate, apologetic, knowing her name, hadn't been a stranger at all. He'd been this child, this innocent boy playing with a toy car, would grow up, learn to travel through time, and go back to force her to kill his own grandfather, because if Harold Brennan hadn't died that day at that exact moment, this child wouldn't exist. Sorry, Ashla, but this needs to happen. The temporal loop closed around her like a fist. The man who destroyed her life was sitting right there, 3 years old, not knowing yet what he would become or the terrible choice he would make to ensure his own existence. Ashla looked at the little boy, happy, healthy, loved. She felt something shift inside her. Not forgiveness, not peace, but understanding, a terrible, profound understanding of necessity, of brutal, unforgiving mathematics. I'm okay, Ashla said quietly. I think I understand now. Bogan nodded. My company hires people with criminal records who've shown real rehabilitation. There's a job waiting for you when you get out, administrative work, but it's a start. Why? Ashla whispered. Because you saved my life, Bogan said simply. You showed me Sai could be better than something other than what I was. They talked for the rest of the visiting hour. When the guard announced time was up, Bogan stood. I'll come back next month, she said. You're not alone anymore. As Bogan gathered Addison, the boy waved. Bye-bye, he called out. Ashla waved back, watching the birthmark on his cheek glow in the fluorescent light. Back in her cell that night, Ashla lay on her bunk and stared at the ceiling instead of the wall. For the first time in 10 years, she allowed herself to think about what had really happened that day, A man from somewhere else had appeared in a flash of purple light. He had known her name. He had given her an impossible weapon. He had forced her to kill Harold Brennan, and he had said it needed to happen. What if it did? What if that death had set in motion everything that followed? Bogan's transformation, her groundbreaking research, the birth of a child who might grow up to do something important. The thought was terrifying. It meant her life, her suffering, her imprisonment had been orchestrated by forces beyond her control. It meant she never had a choice. Ashla closed her eyes and prayed, not to God, but to the universe itself, to whatever force had sent that man in strange clothes. If this needed to happen, she whispered into the darkness, then let it mean something. Let it be worth it. The universe didn't answer, but somewhere in Austin, a little boy with a birthmark fell asleep dreaming of futures not yet written, and in a laboratory, a woman who had once been a monster worked late on equations that would unlock the secrets of time and space. 2 years later, Ashla walked out of the prison into bright Texas sunlight. Bogan was waiting with Sarah and Addison, who was 5 now and full of questions. Ready? Bogan asked. Ashla looked back at the prison one last time, then at the family waiting, then at the road ahead. Yeah, she said, I'm ready. She climbed into Bogan's car and they drove toward Austin, toward a job and an apartment and a future that she had once only imagined. Addison chattered in the back seat about kindergarten and dinosaurs and the spaceship he would build when he grew up. Ashla listened and smiled and tried not to think about the strange knife or the man in impossible clothes or the purple flash that had changed everything. Months later, she woke in her small Austin apartment with her cat curled at her feet and morning sun streaming through the windows. She got ready for work at the company changing the world, one impossible discovery at a time. And she thought about half chances and how sometimes the worst thing that ever happened to you could also be the thing that saved you. She thought about a little boy with a birthmark and wondered what role he would play in the story still being written. She had made her peace with necessity. The universe worked not with justice or fairness, but with the brutal calculus of cause and effect that cared nothing for individual suffering and everything for the larger pattern. And Ashla Reeves, unwilling instrument of fate, had finally accepted that. It Needs to Be Awesome Sounding by Daniel Rogers. An average person has 15 points where a knockwalk can poke, pinch, or karate chop to put that person to sleep. If successful, the person gets a good night's sleep or a nap, depending on the time of day. But if the knockwalk botches, the person could easily turn on him. And if that person is an elite guard, the results could be really bad, like the kind you don't wake up from. Knockwalking can be very dangerous. But knocking, walking is what we have to do to rescue Alora. Why knock walking? Why not something awesome sounding like taking out or neutralizing? I kept trying to convince Drock to change the name of putting people to sleep with no violence. We've always called it knock walking. For hundreds of years, Drock said. Clearly you have the past on your side, but I have the future. It's time to update and leave the past behind. A used ship salesman had nothing on me. I had him against the ropes and could sense an imminent change coming. Drock remained silent for whole minutes, making me feel awkward. I'm not a fan of silence. Finally, Drock broke the awkwardness. No, the past stays. The future is highly overrated. It remains knock walking. Now, let's get a bite to eat. Drock strolled off towards the food hut with me in pursuit. After dinner, Bob, Drock, and I moved to a private hut to discuss our plans to rescue Alora. Only the best should go, Drock said. I know you're a god, but do you know knock walk? Not personally, but how hard can it be? There's no way I'm staying behind. Drew, it takes a lifetime to master knockwalk, Bob said, and even then, only a few of those who study the art ever achieve master status. Like you said, I'm a god. Train me and see if I can't master knockwalk enough to go with you. Bob looked at Drock. That sounds like a reasonable request. We have a couple of days until the rain moves out. We can't make a move until then, so why not train him while we wait? Drock wasted no time. We marched to the practice field, completely soaked, and began with a dummy. He pointed out the 15 points, the 6 you poke, the 5 you pinch, and the 4 you karate chop. I tore that dummy to pieces, hitting every point with precision. I guess those 3 boxing lessons finally paid off, and everyone said I wouldn't use them. So, what do you think? I asked Drock. You move too much. You must be still and balanced. But hey, you've got to be impressed. I'm knocking the tar out of this dummy. Now tell me the truth. You didn't think I had it in me, did you? Drock motioned to a knockwalk and softly spoke in his ear. A few minutes later, 3 knockwalks returned wearing padded vests and helmets. Why don't you try knocking the tar out of real people? Drock smiled. Sure, why not? Who wants to go first? I waved like I've seen guys do in the movies, a small come-here wave that looks so cool. The tallest one moved forward. He will turn his back to you, then you must put him to sleep with 1 move. If you fail, he will turn and engage, Drock said a little too cheerily. The tall knockwalk turned his back to me, and I karate chopped him. He didn't fall or budge or even acknowledge that I just hit him with everything I had. You can start whenever you're ready, the tall one said. Don't be gentle, I can handle it. I hit him again and again, nothing. The 3rd time I sprained my hand. Don't be shy, this isn't my first practice. Start whenever you're ready. Sure, but I need to meditate first. I never knockwalk before meditating. The tall knockwalk bowed and returned with the others. I whispered to Drock, you made your point. He dismissed the others, and we went to his hut to get out of the rain. So if I can't knock walk, what can I do? I can't just do nothing. Alora needs me, I said over the pounding of the rain on the roof. Alora needs you to be you. Oh, no, I'm no good. I need to be more, a better fighter, a better leader, or better anything. Until you are at peace with who you are, you can't be at peace. And a man without peace cannot help others. So if I have peace, I can help Alora? Yes. What kind of mambo jumbo is that? How can I be at peace when she's out there? Tell you what, you show me how I can help, and that will give me a little more peace. Why don't we start there? Drock shrugged. We could use a lookout. There, was that so hard? We could have saved a lot of time if you had just started with that. The rain stopped the next day, and that night our team gathered for a last meeting before rescuing Alora. Bob began, I've discovered Targan has Alora at his summer house on the edge of the city. Several elite guards patrol the place. As long as the rain stays away, you should be able to put them to sleep and get Alora out before Targan even knows what happened. I have a question, I asked. What's up with the rain? Will you all melt or something? I'm surprised you don't know, Bob said. Knock walking doesn't work in the rain. I stared at Drock, who refused to look at me. You mean to tell me that no one can use knock walk in the rain? Drock looked at his feet. Correct. The dampness throws off the pressure used to knock walk accurately. I'm surprised Drock didn't tell you. Must have slipped his mind. I stared at Drock again. This time, Drock found something interesting on the ceiling. The knockwalks applied dark war paint and dressed in black. Some meditated while others practiced their moves. We enthusiastically left the hut for Targan's house when it suddenly poured on us. The knockwalks' war paint smeared and withered our enthusiasm. Alora must wait another day. I'm sure she's fine, but I'm not. It's driving me crazy knowing she's a prisoner, and that's all my fault. I'm not sure what I could have done, but I should have done something. I returned to the hut and saw Drax sitting in the corner. I may not be able to do anything for Alora, but I'm certainly going to do something about Drax. Drax saw me coming. Oh my, look at the time. It's time to meditate. He jumped out the door quicker than I could catch him. The game might be rained out for tonight, but I won't stop until Alora is back and Drax gets a piece of my mind.
Revisited by Christine Richardson. Honey, I'm home. Danny warbled the words cheerfully, savoring them, willing himself to forget that he lived alone now and no one would answer. He closed the door gently, hung up his suit jacket, and loosened his tie. He imagined Carlotta emerging from the kitchen, swathed in her homespun apron, a dusting of flour on her nose and cheek, like a visitation of early winter snowflakes. There would be greetings and hugs and kisses and maybe a little hanky-panky on the couch before she confessed that her culinary efforts had led to disaster and they would have to order out. She had a dozen restaurants on speed dial, none of them cheap. He would smile and hand over his credit card, trying not to worry too much. But those days were over now. Tonight, he would microwave a frozen dinner and eat it alone, watching the news and reflecting that many other people had it worse than he did. He, at least, had his own one-bedroom condo with a flexible mortgage, a dry place to sleep, and a stack of marked-down dining options from the warehouse depot. It was past 6 o'clock. The traffic had been terrible, with construction delays, so it was time to shove one of those dinners into the microwave. But it was rarely hungry these days, and nothing tasted right without Carlotta's smile. He checked his phone one more time, hoping for a text message, an email, a death notice, anything. He had no idea where Carlotta was or what she was doing, and he needed desperately to know why she had disappeared on a Thursday afternoon in June, leaving no clues other than her abandoned possessions scattered around his condo. She had taken nothing with her except her purse. He had not dared to move anything for over a month, because she always took offense if he touched her things. Everything was now neatly repacked in her suitcase and stowed in the back of the closet, waiting. Waiting patiently day after day, hoping against hope, waiting as the seconds ticked by in a mournful parade with no end in sight. Danny parked himself on the couch and started going through his mail. Maybe he had missed something personal hidden between advertisements, charitable appeals, and self-aggrandizing leaflets from political candidates. Maybe. Always maybe. Hello, Danny boy. How was your day? Carlotta's voice, rich and sultry, inviting him to paradise. Danny's head jerked up. Carlotta was standing in the entryway to the kitchen, leaning against the wall, swathed in the apron he had folded like a holy relic before depositing it in her suitcase. There was a spot of flour on her nose and on her left cheek, just as he remembered. He opened his mouth, closed it again, and then blurted out the first thing that came to mind. "Lose the apron, Carly. We both know you can't cook." He was horrified by his harshness. She hated to be called Carly, and pouted every time he suggested that she should upgrade her culinary skill. But what right did she have to expect anything else? She had been missing for almost 3 months. The apron vanished, along with the gobs of flour. Carlotta sashayed towards him and plunked herself on the couch.
She was wearing her turquoise T-shirt split almost to her navel. He longed to bury his face in her cleavage and inhale the vertiginous fusion of rose and frankincense that erased all logic. But something was terribly wrong, and he had to investigate. "What are you?" he asked. She smiled. "Don't worry, I ordered a pizza." Just like Carlotta, to completely ignore his pointedly relevant question, if this was some sort of entity, it knew her well. "Kale and anchovies," he said automatically. She responded with a sardonic laugh. "No, silly. Canadian with extra bacon and black olives, your favorites." "But you won't touch that. You believe that pigs are sentient and more intelligent than the average human." "I'm not Carlotta. I'm a memory engram. Part of you. Whatever you like, I like." It had to be a dream, a really crazy dream, but the doorbell was ringing. It was the pizza delivery guy. The box he handed Danny wafted a tantalizing aroma that made his taste buds dance. He decided to enjoy the moment. There had to be a logical explanation, and he might as well relax while he was figuring it out. He carried the box back to the living room, deposited it on the coffee table, and opened it. The first bite was heaven. "You want some?" he asked between bites. "Help yourself." "I'm not able to eat, but I am sharing in your enjoyment." "There are some cans of Diet Coke in the fridge. Could you fetch me a couple?" "I wish I could, but I'm an engram. A neurocerebral construct. I don't have a body." Danny considered that information while he walked to the fridge and back. "What are you?" he asked again. "If you're an engram, what are you doing on my couch? You should be safely stored in my hippocampus." "I don't fully understand what happened. Your obsession with Carlotta was eating up more and more storage space, creating a neurocrisis. It needed to discharge somehow, so here I am. Now we can talk face to face. How did you order that pizza?" "I am part of you. I know your credit card number and anything else you have memorized." "I hope you added a tip. I don't have any cash in the house." "Right. Just 3/4 in the drawer of your computer desk. Cash makes you nervous because you can't track it online." Danny was impressed. This version of Carlotta really did know everything about him. That was threatening, but also strangely comforting. If anyone could understand him, it would be her. "How could you order a pizza without my knowledge or consent?" he demanded. "You had a strong, repressed craving. You would have ordered it yourself eventually." Danny took another bite, grunting with satisfaction. How could he have deprived himself for so long? There had been no Canadian pizzas with extra bacon and black olives during Carlotta's reign. Everything had been about her. Everything had been about her. But it had been so worth it. Coming home to warmth and cleavage and perfume, even if Carlotta was the queen of messes and her preferred food was overpriced and unpleasant to eat. Danny finished a third piece of pizza and opened the second can of Coke. He sat back, more contented than he had since Carlotta's disappearance. Carlotta, or her reasonable facsimile, watched him with that familiar half-smile. "So, what happens now?" he asked. "I'm not sure. I think you need some reality therapy. Carlotta is not coming back, and that's a good thing. She's a con artist and was just using you until she found a new sugar daddy. You know all those times she told you she was going for job interviews? She was following up on dating site contacts. What? That's crazy. Danny bounced to his feet, floundering in tidal waves of emotion. Engram Carlotta's claims were outrageous, like kicks to his gonads, but his gut was telling him that she was not lying. He towered over her, willing her to change her story. How could you possibly know what Carlotta was up to? I don't know. It just happened. Around the time that Elon Musk was launching Neuralink, my abilities began to expand. I could surf the internet everywhere, even places you didn't want to go. I started stalking Carlotta, reading her social media feeds and text messages. Danny vividly remembered the breaking news about Neuralink, how human brains were being melded with artificial intelligence to overcome disabilities. He had been disturbed by the thought, but at the same time, the idea was tantalizing. Had some of that AI energy leaked beyond its specifications, perhaps into the internet? Have you become self-aware? He asked Engram Carlotta. I don't know exactly what that is supposed to mean. I am experiencing new urges. I shared your enjoyment of the pizza, but I would like to have a body of my own so I can have a first-hand taste experience. I want to explore everything beyond anything you have ever imagined. Her voice trailed off, and she stared into space as if she were looking back 50 light years through the Hubble. There is so much to explore. Danny sat mesmerized. This version of Carlotta could not offer him sexual delights, but she could be the best friend he ever had. We could learn a lot from each other, he said. You can learn something from me right now. If you look at your text messages, you will see a photo of interest. He picked up his phone reluctantly, closing his eyes, hoping everything would magically return to 3 months ago. It had been far from ideal and prohibitively expensive, but it was the best sex he had ever had. Cut it out! Carlotta's voice jolted him back into the present. Look at the photo. Danny looked. He gave a low whistle. Where did you get this? While you were pining, I was investigating. With a little effort, you could have done it yourself. You're sure it's not photoshopped or anything? It's the real thing. That's Armenio Arbacer, head of Argentina's most powerful drug enterprise. And Carlotta married him? How did they even meet? Dating site. He bought her a plane ticket and off she flew. She will do well. He's noted for his generous divorce settlements and non-disclosure agreements. So you found this out independently, even though I didn't want to know? You wanted to know. You were just afraid. Danny sighed. I'm a good programmer, but hopelessly pathetic where emotions are concerned. You can change. Then we'll both be happier. Where do we start? Throw Carlotta's suitcase in the dumpster. There's good stuff in there. I'll take it to Goodwill tomorrow. Some things just need to be dumped. Do yourself a favor. Danny chugged the last of his Coke and marched to the bedroom. He dragged the suitcase from the closet and headed out the door. When he returned, he was smiling. That felt good. What's next? You start living your life. You're imagining some sort of comfy relationship with me, but you deserve something better than talking to a projection of yourself. You need the warmth of human companionship. Ow, Danny said. You know I'm clueless in that department. Stephanie at work likes you. Talk to her. Really? I had no idea. I really admire her creativity. She always manages to take a leap outside the box when we reach an impasse with a project. She has a great personality in other ways. The Rose Cafe is her favorite coffee shop. Invite her for a pick-me-up after work. Get to know her. Ask her out. Will you coach me? Coach yourself. You know everything I know. Can't you and I just carry on together for a while? Sort of a practice run? Forget it, Anne Graham Carlotta said, and disappeared. Danny was never sure afterwards whether the whole thing had been a dream or perhaps a fugue state that had allowed him to order the pizza without being aware of what he was doing. Whatever happened, his life started to change for the better that day. He never saw either version of Carlotta again and didn't miss him a bit. He was far too busy getting to know Stephanie.